two little vignettes.
That's right. All right, if you're just joining us, you're late. I'm sorry.
What can you do?
So anyway, we're now talking about the development of the Talmud Bavli. So Rav is in Sura, Shmuel is in Pumbedisa. They have their two academies. What's their purpose? It's to unpack the Mishnah. The Mishnah here is very terse. It doesn't give you the sources. It doesn't give you all the applications. But they're in two different Batei Medrash. They're in two different cities. They're essentially setting up a yeshiva where they're talking about. They will have, and if you're Rav and Shmuel, you know all the different Mishnayos, but they will have like Chazar Bachrim, as they would say in Europe. They would have rabbis who were memorizers. They would come and they would say, okay, tell me all the brises you know. God would come to town and he would say, I'm a memorizer. What are the brises that you know? And he would tell you all the brises. Right? These are these parallel texts that are authoritative but not quite as much as the Mishnah. They're going to introduce that into the learning. And now we're going to have two kind of developments. You're going to have statements by these various Amoraim, and then later Amoraim are going to develop them and unpack them and try to explain them. And other ones, you're going to have stories. The Talmud is going to say, oh, you know, one day Rav was walking on the field and he said this and that. So the later Rav is going to say, well, why did he say this and that? And this is going to be the continuing development of the Mishnah. So if you look on the next page, you have here a chart from this little book, which is a classic work. It's called Aiding Talmud Study. It has beautiful charts. It has lots of good numbers, translation words. If you want to get into the study of Gemara, this is a great place to start. Aryeh Carmel, it's a classic work. It's called Aiding Talmud Study, Siyata LeGemara. So he charts it out for us. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 major generations of Amoraim. Starting from the top around the year 2000, you see the two academies. Look on the left side of the page because that's the Amorai Bavel, the Babylonian Talmud. Rav and Shmuel. Rav had several students, Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda. Rav Yehuda also was a student of Shmuel. So you're going to open a random page of Talmud, and you're going to say, Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Rav. Rav Yehuda said in the name of Rav, because he was a student of Rav. But he'll also say, Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Shmuel. I heard this from Shmuel. And what are they trying to figure out? What's the halacha in this particular case in the Mishnah? How do we relate that into another case? What's the source? The Mishnah didn't tell us the source. How do we apply it? Other areas of life, because the Gemara is not just about halacha. All kinds of agaritas, because if you distill a Jewish person just to the robotics of a mechanistic halachic life, so then they're going to be crippled spiritually. And the rabbis of the Talmud were very aware of this, and therefore there became a synthesis. If you open the Talmud, what do we call that section? We call that the Agadata, the homiletic section. And some of it's very difficult to understand, because they spoke oftentimes in references that that seem silly, but well understood in the context. I'll give an example. I don't know, imagine World War I, and you're, I don't know, the Kaiser, and you're declaring war. So what's the story in the next, you know, the Frankfurt Daily Telegraph? So the next morning, imagine the morning after Kaiser Wilhelm declares war, it says, 10,000 soldiers drown in a drop of ink. That's the headline. So now we open that today, almost 100 years after. So what do you say when you read that headline? What does it mean, right? Well, one thing you could say is these people are obviously stupid. How could 10,000 people drown in a drop of ink? They're obviously not very bright, the people who wrote this, right? But what does it mean?
It's an expression.
What's the expression referring to? Right, the declaration of war. So that's exactly what happens in the Talmud. You have people, unfortunately, who read Midrashic literature, which appears in the Midrash and in the Talmud. It's the same people. And they're describing these homilies. And the rabbi says, you know, it's like a guy who was on a giant fish, and the fish got up out of the water, and then he made a fire on the back of the fish. Everybody goes, ah, bunch of idiots. These rabbis are such fools. You got to look in the mirror when you say that. If you're saying that, you got to look in the mirror. Because obviously, the rabbis are trying to tell you something in a backhanded, subtle way. So it's exactly like drowning in a drop of ink. You just have to understand the context. You have to understand the implications of what they were saying to whom and why. And all those pieces fit together. But the rabbi is going to spend a lot of the time in the Talmud, not just passing on the halachic tradition, but also passing on values, educational values. All kinds of different values are being passed along from generation to generation, all the way through these various cities. And that's what happens. When you open a page of Talmud, take a look at the next page. Those of you who have your Gemara Shabbos, this is the first page of Masechet Shabbos. The Gemara starts in the middle section of the text with a Mishnah. A Mishnah is this selection that was edited by Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. And then you see my little box on the bottom? Gimel Mem is short for Gemara. Gemara means something that we learned. We learned this. And then the rabbis go on to explain, to expand, to compare. Sometimes the Gemara will say, Minohani Mili, how do I know this? They're going to unpack that piece of the Mishnah. How does Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi know this? I know he got it from somewhere. Well, what's the source? So that'll be a significant chunk of the Talmud. Another one will be, okay, Tanan Hasan, we learned in a different Mishnah. Now let's compare it. Let's take this as one giant corpus and try to figure out what's the meaning of the juxtaposition of these two pieces. So what's happening now to our tradition is really quite remarkable because it began as primarily an oral tradition in addition to the Tanakh. Now it moved, then it moved to the Mishnayos where you have essentially the note cards. Now the tradition is actually being put on the table to say, okay, this is where it comes from and this is how we apply it. But because there are rabbinic tools in the toolbox, different rabbis and different schools are going to apply it differently. So you're going to see a page of Gemara where they'll have a statement from Rav. So Rav, we mentioned before, is a first generation Amora. He's living in Sura. And the Gemara will quote his statement. And then the Gemara will then say, you know, we have a statement from Shmuel. A different perspective on the same issue. It's going to develop down, let's say, through the students. And then they're going to have a question. Well, how do we rule? So one of the later, let's say, Abaye or Rava. These were two also interlocutors on a regular basis. They're going to debate. What do we say now? Now that we look in hindsight, we've got Shmuel over here. We've got Rav. We've discussed it in our base medrash. What do we think is the more cogent opinion? And then we're going to have to come, in many cases, we're going to come to some kind of consensus. Sometimes it'll be in two Bate Medrash. One base Medrash will say, the halacha is like Rav. And then the other base Medrash in the same Talmud will say, halacha kishmuel. Isn't that kind of strange? When you first read Talmud, it's like strange. How could the Gemara say, hilchasa k'rav, the halacha is like Rav. And then the Gemara says, no, hilchasa kishmuel. Well, it's two different Bate Medrash. It's two different schools who are studying this topic with different perspectives. So here they are, kind of developing as it goes. Sometimes the issues get solved, and sometimes they don't. Sometimes you have to figure out later on, how do we follow? So this is all going on till about the year 500. Yeah?
What's going on in Israel this time
with the Talmud Yerushalmi? So the Talmud Yerushalmi is wrapping up around 300. There was always a yeshuv in Eretz Israel, and there were always, well, I shouldn't say there were always Talmidei Chachamim, because if you look at the time of the Rambam, we'll talk about it a little bit later, so there weren't, unfortunately, Talmidei Chachamim because they had just been sacked in the beginning of the 13th century. But there were Talmidei Chachamim who were going on, who were studying and who were teaching, but it continued to dwindle. That's why if you look on the chart on the previous page, you will see that the number of Amoraim after the first generation and then the Hasimus Talmud Yerushalmi, there are no major rabbinic figures of note. You want to know what's interesting, just as a sidebar. We may go overtime because of this sidebar, but it's not my fault. If you look on the right side of this chart, you see where it says Kvias Haluach? If you go down to the year 4100 of the Jewish Hillel, you see the guy, Chas V'Shalom. The rabbi next to him, Reb Hillel, he is a descendant, he's called Hillel Hasheni, because his great-great-great-great-grandfather was Hillel HaZaken, the famous Hillel. Hillel Hasheni, he lived around the year 300, and this was essentially at the time when the settlement in Israel of scholars is falling apart. And the Rambam writes in Hilchos Kiddush HaChodesh, you can't set the new moon unless you're in Israel. It's a function of the Jewish community. And the true Jewish community does not include us. We are not part of the Jewish community. We feel bad about that, but we're not, because we're not living in Eretz Yisrael. Eretz Yisrael, those are the real Jews of the Jewish community. We're Jewish, it's good, but we're not part of the real Jewish community. So we can't set when Rosh Chodesh is. So Hillel Hasheni looked and he says, wait a second, this is going to go down, no one's going to have a calendar. So he set at that time, forever and ever, and ever, the set of calendars that we have. He set the Luach. The reason why he set it then was because that was essentially the last grand stand of the rabbinic community in Israel. And if that would have fallen apart, we would have to rely on the 5 farmers, the 10 farmers who are in Israel. So that wouldn't be a good situation. So because of the downfall of the Jewish community there, they actually had to set the Luach. If you ask the Rambam, why do we have Yom Kippur today when we have it? It's because of this Jewish community in Israel, of Hillel Hasheni.
Are the halachos in the Talmud Yerushalmi and Talmud Babli different?
The answer is many of them are similar, many of them are different. Because of the fact that the Talmud Yerushalmi we mentioned was edited under the pressure of the Roman government, it has less clear, and it is, according to many Achronim, not as authoritative as the Bavli. However, there are many instances. Someone told me that one of the Rabbanim, maybe it was, I never saw the Sefer, but maybe it was Rav Maimon, edited an entire book where he collects all the times where the Rambam follows the Yerushalmi. Sometimes there are poskim who will follow the Yerushalmi even over the Bavli. That's very uncommon. But you will have many times where the Yerushalmi is brought to bear in terms of interpreting the halacha of a sugya that's not clear in the Bavli. Usually when there's a dispute, we follow the Bavli. But the Yerushalmi will come up occasionally.
But aren't there halachos in Yerushalmi that had to do only with Israel? They said the Bavli didn't.
Yes, okay. So that's a good point. We probably should talk about this. The Talmud Yerushalmi also includes sections of Zra'im, of the laws that are relevant to the land of Israel that are not included in the Talmud Bavli. So today, in the last, let's say, 150 years, since, thank God, we've had Shivas Sion coming in the second Aliyah with the Rothschild in the 1880s. So then, all of a sudden, now all these religious farmers are settling these places, and they have Shilas, Truma, Maser, Leket, Chicha. So all of a sudden, the Yerushalmi became very much alive for the people who are living in Eretz Yisrael. There was a forgery, for those, any people who are history buffs, there was a forgery in Europe of the Yerushalmi on Seder Kodshim. We know there are six orders of the Mishnah. Zroin, Moed, Nashim, Nezikim, Kodshim, Taros. The fifth one, which refers to the Avodah and the Beis HaMikdash, there was a guy who was obviously a very brilliant man who forged the entire Talmud Yerushalmi. He claims he found it. He wrote the whole thing from scratch. He sent it to Rabbanim and he got a skumas until someone figured it out that it was a forgery and they tossed it out. But it was obviously a great genius. This is a whole literature in and of itself. Famous rabbinic forgeries. That is one of the chief ones. That is one of the chief ones. There are also some other responsa, very prominent responsa, that are also forgeries. They say it was the name of this one. It really wasn't that. But the Talmud Yerushalmi, it also includes the sections related to the laws of the land, whereas the Bavli does not. The Bavli includes Moed, so laws of the time, the calendar, Nashim, all kinds of marriage, divorce, husband-wife responsibility, Kodshim, it includes, meaning the laws of the sacrifices, hopefully one day we'll have that very soon, Nezikim, my ox scores your ox, my seal gets out of the Duluth Zoo today and eats your plants, it happens, and then it has only one in Taros, and that's Nida. So it's primarily based on four, whereas according to the Yerushalmi, if you're learning the Yerushalmi, you'll also have Zerayim. Okay? Sure, you can ask as many questions as you want. We may be here till tomorrow, but the Franks don't mind.
This Rav Hillel who did the calendar,
yeah.
Who was he?
He was, if you look carefully, he was a son of Rabbi Yehuda, who is the son of Rabbi Gamliel, who is the son of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. That means he's a direct descendant of David HaMelech. So he was the president, he was the Nasi of the Jewish community in Israel. So he was really the political leader and the religious leader at the same time, who was a descendant of Rabbi Gamliel. If you go back to the top of the chart, we see Rabbi Gamliel. That's the Rabbi Gamliel who was a little bit later than the Rabbi Gamliel that we talk about at the... anyway, it's a long story. Rabbi Gamliel with the Seder, whatever. Anyway.
So he was the first one, the second one? I didn't get
there were several Rabbi Gamliels. This one,
Hillel.
There were two Hillels. Yeah. This one is called Hillel Hasheni, the second Hillel. Okay. The first Hillel is much earlier. It's Hillel lived... He lives before the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. So he's living around the year zero, Hillel.
Is that Hillel and Shammai?
Yes, that Hillel and Shammai is living around the year zero when the Beis HaMikdash is still standing with the B'nai B'Seira. This Hillel is living 250 years after the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. So you're talking about a differential of almost 400 years between Hillel the first and Hillel the second.
And they're related or not related?
Yeah, they are direct descendants, one from the other. Okay? They both live in Eretz Yisrael. Has anybody been sufficiently confused that they're passing out yet? No. All right, we did our job. So far, so good. So this is like a ridiculously short overview of the Talmud. Okay, that's the role of the Talmud, is to unpack the Mishnah. You're going to have the different schools. You're going to have the different components. It's going to develop over time. About year 500, if you're looking on your chart here still, Ravina and Ravashi, the Gemara says in Bava Metzia, Ravina, Ravashi, Sof Hora'ah. That's the end of Psak. The end of the ruling is Ravina, Ravashi. So that's right here about the year 450. You see at the bottom of your column, they edited the Talmud. And that's it. The Rambam writes, the Kesef Mishnah, the commentary on the Rambam, we'll get to the Rambam a little bit. The Kesef Mishnah writes that all the Jewish people accepted that we don't argue on the Talmud. And essentially, it makes sense, because this was the last major kibbutz of all Chachmei Yisrael, all the major rabbinic figures in one place who had a conversation with each other. Today we have very great rabbinic figures. They don't talk to each other. This one's over here and this one's over there. There's no one unified community. Here, it's all within the same few blocks. So they're over, kind of harving over the same issues. Ravina Ravashi, they're living in Sura or in the neighborhood of Masa Machasya, the same kind of place. They're going to close it out. What they say, including the Talmud. The thing is, though, not all the things in the Talmud are clear. You know, so many things are left unresolved in terms of how they rule. But now we have this great, incredible corpus of knowledge. This is the Talmud. This is going to guide how we live. Well, how do we understand it? How do we relate it to us going later? So in the next couple hundred years, there were rabbis who were called the Savoroi, who continued the similar style of study of Talmud. But again, the Talmud is closed. There's nothing that they are going to add. Once in a while, you study Talmud, you'll see there's one of the Rishonim, let's say the Ritva, we'll talk about later, says, oh, this little section actually somehow got stuck in there, but it really belonged to the Savoroim. It's not actually authoritative Talmud. That's an interesting discussion about manuscripts. You know, the printing press didn't come into existence until first Talmud, I think, was published around 1500, 1520, something like that. Until then, it was manuscripts. So you can get a little toast in the manuscript. You get different manuscripts that we have today. You go to Oxford or Munich or JTS, all kinds of places where they have Talmudic manuscripts in the old days. Anyway, so now the Savoroim are studying, then becomes the period of the Gaonim, where in Iraq there still is a yeshiva. The yeshiva was called Gaon Yaakov. So whoever the leader of the yeshiva was called the Gaon. The period is known as the period of the Gaonim. But it would be like calling, if the yeshiva was called Netzer Yisrael, so it would be called the guy Netzer, and then would it be called the Netzarim? The Gaon was the head of the yeshiva. Most of these Gaonim were great Talmid HaChachamim, incredible scholars. They wrote many responses that are very important. Some of them were good fundraisers. So they were sending, you know, letters to get money for their yeshivas from, this is an old story, not new. So they're sending money all over the world to the Jewish communities in Spain and North Africa, all kinds of other places. They weren't necessarily the greatest Talmid Chacham. They're called Gaon because he was the head of the yeshiva. But it doesn't mean that he was the greatest Gaon. Some Gaonim were great scholars and some of them were, okay. They were just, so over time, they developed a kind of a tradition. Whose response are really weighty and who are just, you know, they were good fundraisers, but their response are not as weighty. So now we're going to get to the time of the Rishonim. That's really what is going to interest us for the remainder of our time tonight. So I wanted to, in my outline on the front page, I'm breaking this up between two tekufot, Sfarad number one and Sfarad number two. Same thing with Ashkenaz number one and Ashkenaz number two. Let's start with Sfarad. Let's start with the Sephardic tradition, North Africa. And this is how you'll see why it is that when you go, I went to a Sephardic bris today, then they're singing all kinds of things. I had to tell my kids, this is a special thing. You go with the Sephardic tradition, the la 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 la, la singing, saying, the who knows what they're doing, they're saying Shechianu. This is a Gaval de Gazach. But we're not exposed to this. Well, where does it come from? Why are they doing it differently than the Ashkenazim? Well, there's a whole development of this. It's not just somebody woke up one morning. There's an incredible rich tradition, both in the Sephardic side and in the Ashkenazic side, and they're going to relate to each other. They're going to interact with each other. To me, it's awesome. It's awesome how you see the development of the communities over the course of a thousand years, you're talking. So there's an amazing story that's recorded in several volumes in the year 960 that essentially set the tone for the Jewish community forever. There were four scholars, rabbis, who were living in Italy, because there was a Jewish community in Italy from the time of the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. There were Jews who went from Israel on the Mediterranean and settled in Italy. There's a whole thing about Minhag Italia, very old. They have their own unique Minhagim, which are connected to Eretz Yisrael. Forget the Sephardim Ashkenazim. They have their own thing going on because they were exiled, went straight there and connect. They wrote letters back and forth to Israel. It's a very interesting thing. People who go to Italy, they find special Minhagi Italia. They had their own tradition of great Rabbanim who lived there, who were connected not necessarily with other communities. So 960, four great rabbis set out. They were on a journey to go raise funds for their yeshivas in Italy. They had two great yeshivas. They're going to raise funds. And they get hijacked by pirates. And the pirates, who obviously are there for the business, they ransom them to Jewish communities all up and down the coast of North Africa. Now, they don't realize that these are four of the greatest scholars in the world. This is a Maaseh Shehayah. It's written in several different Sfarim. They don't realize that it's a famous story of the four captives. We know who three of them are. The fourth one, we don't know who it was. These Jewish communities up and down North Africa contact, they happen to be, the pirates were associated with the government, of course, in some way, so they got a hold of these pirates, and they were ransomed by different Jewish communities, and they essentially established Torah centers wherever they landed. There were Jewish communities in Spain all the way back for hundreds and hundreds of years, since before the Muslims got there. There were Jews living in Spain all this time. But it wasn't the center of Jewish learning. There was Jewish learning going on there. In Cordova, they ransomed someone by the name of Rav Moshe ben Chanoch. Cordova is going to be a very important city later. So Cordova now has a major Talmud Chacham who's setting up a city. Tunisia is going to have a Rav by the name of Rav Hushiel. Egypt is going to have someone by the name of Rav Shmaria. So now you're getting major Jewish communities in these areas. So I want to take a look first.
So after they went, they did not return to Italy.
They didn't. And they settled in these places. And now they're going to create huge Torah centers in these places, particularly in Sfarad in Spain. So I want to talk about three... I don't know. That's a good question. But remember, think about, if you're living in the Middle Ages, you know, family is nice, family is important, but your life is more important than that. So the Ramban, we're going to get to one of my famous favorite heroes, the Ramban, after his... All right, I'll spill the beans right now. He had a famous disputation in 1263 where he disputed Pablo Cristiani in Barcelona in front of King James of Aragon, and he won the disputation. He then recorded it in writing, and once he recorded it, he was sentenced to death. The Jewish community pressured King James, and they commuted his sentence to exile. The Ramban went alone. He was nearly 70 years old. He went alone to the land of Israel. Alone. We have letters that he wrote to his son. He went by himself. Old man, all alone. So the fact that people were traveling by themselves, it's not such an uncommon occurrence. You read, some of you are familiar that I'm interested in this stuff, and I do a whole Tisha B'Av presentation every year. So right now I'm going to start reading my annual depressing literature. If you go to the Skokie Library, you read like the history of the Jews of the Sephardic lands. And, you know, it's page after page of this guy was captured, and this guy was ransomed, and this guy was killed, and this guy was burnt at the stake. It's, you know, like a litany of woe. It's really horrible stuff. So, you know, it's hard for us to even imagine what living in that kind of world was like. It's very difficult. Anyway, so I want to talk about three Rishonim who are very important. The first one, his name is Rabbeinu Hananel. Rabbeinu Hananel, he was born in Tunisia, and he died in Tunisia. He lived in Tunisia because his father, Rav Hushiel, was ransomed there. So now he's going to become one of the most important, one of the most famous Talmudic commentators. If you look on many Masechtas and Shas, including the one I gave you on Masechta Shabbos, if you look on the left-hand column, you see in the bracket? You see where I bracket in the box on the left-hand column on the page of Talmud? What's that? Of course, there was big Jewish communities there. Big Jewish communities. Rabbeinu Hananel, you will see it on the page. He died in 1055, and he had students who then moved from Tunisia into Spain and influenced other great rabbis, including Rabbeinu Yitzchak Alfasi, the second person I want to mention. So Rabbeinu Hananel, he's a Talmudic commentator. We've got him on the page. Then we have Rabbeinu Yitzchak Alfasi. He was born in Algeria. He was born in Algeria in 1013. He died in Lucena in Spain in 1103. He did something very interesting. We have in the back of every Talmud a thick volume of Talmud. And that is, if you look at the next page, after the map of Spain, I'll get back to that map of Spain in a second. In the back of your Talmud, you have what's called the Rif. The Rif stands for Rabbi Yitzchak Alfasi. Why is his name Yitzchak Alfasi? Because he moved from Nigeria to Fez, Alfasi from Fez. He moves from there to Spain, but he does something very interesting. He takes the Talmud, and he cuts out all the Agarata and all the back and forth, and he just gives you the Halacha. He's not the first one to do this, but he's the first one to do it with the synthesis of the teaching of the Gaonim. So now, we're trying to figure out how do we lead our daily life? Great, I'll look at the Talmud. Okay, I'm looking at it upside down, right side back. I don't know what I'm supposed to do. Just tell me what to do, Rabbi. The Rif says, I'll tell you what to do. This is the Seder of the Gemara, just with the bottom line. So now we're in Sfarad. What's happening in Sfarad? They're explaining the Gemara. They're packaging it for us. And then, who's going to be a student, ultimately, of some of these Chachamim? Rav Moshe ben Maimon, the Rambam. The Rambam lived, he was born in Cordova in 1035. Yes, he was born in Cordova in 1035. His father, Rav Maimon, was his teacher. His father, Rav Maimon's teacher, was Rimi Gash, was a student of Rabbeinu Hananel. So there's a linkage here that the teachings are actually moving downwards. Okay, the Rambam, you can take a look at this, the page of Rambam I gave you on the next page. He's going to move from Spain to Egypt. And there's Jewish community there. Why? Because initially, remember, Rabbi Shmaria had settled in Egypt, so there was a flourishing Jewish community in Cairo when the Rambam arrived there. So this is like section one of Sephardic Jewry, 10 hours of lecture in 10 minutes. The idea is, you have, starting in this 10th century, until the Rambam, let's say, until the Rambam dies in 1104, you have this initial stage of Talmudic study, understanding what the Talmud is saying, bringing it down to a practical bottom line. The Rambam is the first codifier of the laws in this organized manner in which he does. What's interesting is if you go back to the map of Spain, so on the bottom half of your map, you see Algeria, you see Morocco. This is North Africa. This is heavy Arab territory. The Muslims are pushing their way through. All the way, they've got most of Spain, the Muslims, until, let's say, about the 13th century. But the northern cusp of Spain, up at the top here, that's going to remain in Christian hands. Who's the next door neighbor in the north? France. France is the eldest order of the church, right? France is a hardcore church. So the upper edge here is going to remain Christian. And then now, during the 13th century, then you're going to have a pushback. The Christian reconquest of Spain is going to start moving south. So look at the cities now, just by way of reference. On the bottom, you're going to have Toledo. In the middle, on the bottom, Toledo, Cordova, and Seville. These are Spanish areas under Muslim control all the time. And then in the north, Girona and Barcelona are going to have more Christian influence, certainly into the 13th century. Then the Christians are going to start moving down and down and down, ultimately, until they conquer the whole Iberian Peninsula. But this is section one of the Sephardic tradition. I hope I'm being clear because I'm moving kind of fast. Just a snapshot of three major rabbis. If you want a great, easy to read, but very scholarly historical work on the Rishonim, it's very easy to read. It's a classic, it's the art scroll, the Rishonim book. This is an excellent scholarly work. I still remember, Dr. Graf said, this is a good work. It's like, okay, I will get my hands on this work. There are many other works about the Rishonim, but this is something you can read. This is very interesting.
Pictures?
No pictures.
Maps.
So now let's move up north. Let's move to France in the 11th century. So if you look on our map, let's go a little further to our map. Thank you to Google Maps. You're looking at a mixture, because remember, you never know if you're living Alsace-Lorraine, you don't know if it's France or if it's Germany, depending on what day the war is going on. Is it France? Is it Germany? Every 5 minutes it's changing sides. But you have major Ashkenazi Jewish communities, again, dating back here many, many, many years. In the 10th and 11th century, you have the establishment of great Torah centers along the Rhine Valley. Upright, you see Mainz, Worms. There's also a major community there called Speyer. These are major communities in the Rhine Valley. Who lives there? Rabbeinu Gershom Maor HaGola. Rabbeinu Gershom is most famously known for his takanos and his enactments, like you can't marry two wives, you can't open somebody else's email, you have to, all kinds of other things. Rabbeinu Gershom, he was the Rosh Yeshiva in Mainz. He was born in 960, he died in 1040. Who was one of the people who studied in these great yeshivas in Mainz and Worms and Speyer? Rashi. Rashi was born in 1040 in a small town called Troyes. Now, if you look on your map, you see Paris on the left side. You move a little bit east, southeast. That's Troyes. I was there. I have to give Makar Tov to my parents. My parents, when I was in college, they sent me on a course, NYU, a French Jewish history course. And we actually went to some of these cities. We stayed in Paris for 3 weeks. I don't know much French. I know where is the bathroom, right and left. But I spent 3 weeks in France, and we studied French Jewish history, and we went to some of these places. We went to Troyes. There is a monument to Rashi there, even though it's a French peasant town of 500 Gentiles. But there is a monument to Rashi. There's Troyes. So Rashi is born in Troyes in 1040. He travels to Worms, all the way up on the right side. That's where he studies in the Great Academy, and then he comes back to Troyes. In this period now, you have the great Ashkenazi commentaries on the Talmud. So just like you saw, remember on the page, the little Rabbeinu Hananel on the side of the page, many folios in other Masechtas, you'll find Rabbeinu Gershom's commentary on the side. Then Rashi becomes famous. We could spend several weeks talking just about Rashi. Rashi is perhaps the great educator of all time. The great educator. Rashi lived exactly the same time as Rambam, but they never overlapped because the Rambam is all the way down in Cordova and then in Egypt. He didn't last long. Because of the Almohads, there was this radical Islamic group called the Almohads who were essentially torturing the Jewish community there. They were based in Morocco and they were pushing, their influence was pushing through the southern Iberian Peninsula. So the Rambam's father, Maimon, had to get out of there from Cordova. For some reason, he went to Fez, which is bizarre because that was actually the headquarters of the Almohads. He then lasted there for 5 years, and then they got out of there. They traveled. The Rambam ended up in Egypt. That's where he wrote his magnum opus, the Yad HaChazaka. So you're right. At the same time, you're finding the Rambam here, and then you're going to find Rashi over there. But they never meet. These schools never meet. Tsarfas refers to Alsace, Lorraine, Paris. These central French Jewish communities. Okay? So while this is going on, this is primarily what we would call the pshat or the analysis, the exegesis. That's what's going on in the 10th and 11th century in Germany. That finishes just in the nick of time before 1096. What happens in 1096?
Crusades.
What happens in the Crusades? Largely the Jewish communities of France, the left side, they're spared. Even though the Crusades started in France, what really, Rachman Litzlan, got destroyed and decimated? The Rhine Valley. So Worms, Speyer, and Mainz butchered between Iyar and Sivan, 1096. We have a special two kinos for them on Tisha B'Av. They're going to get destroyed. But, as Dr. Graf pointed out, it didn't have a long-term effect on the Jewish community's intellectual cultivation because those yeshivas essentially had been in decline since Rashi moves on. Rashi leaves, goes back to Troyes, the Torah continues to develop. Had Rashi stayed in Worms, who knows what would have happened? Rashi comes back to Troyes, everything is destroyed on the Rhine Valley, but now the Torah focus shifts to France, shifts more to central France. Okay? So that is Sephardic 1, Ashkenazic 1. Okay? Now we're going to move to France number 2. So far, any questions, comments, observations? We're doing good. So they had, let's say, people like Ibn Ezra and other people who were in the Sephardic tradition. I'm not even talking about Chumash commentaries right now. Other Menachem Ibn Saruch and Dunash Ibn Labrat, these are older grammarians, Hebrew grammarians, and some of them commentators on the Chumash. So now, Rashi has a grandson. His name is Rav Yaakov. His father's name was Rav Meir ben Shmuel. Rashi's daughter married a rabbi by the name of Rav Meir ben Shmuel. He has a son whose name is Rabbeinu Tam. His name is Yaakov. They call him Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam changes the universe. He changes the universe. Because Rashi, this is what Rashi does. Rashi says, I have a page of Talmud. I want to understand what is the page in front of me. Rashi is the great educator, so he can anticipate every question you're going to have. There's something that's not smooth about the text, there's something that's going to bother you about this text, he will be on it. That's the mark of a great educator. He can anticipate all the questions, and he does his explanation with such terseness, with such brevity, that it's ingenious what Rashi does. It's amazing. So Rashi is here kind of smoothing out all the Talmud page. But imagine, I use this analogy a lot. Could be some of you have heard this from me before. A couple of years ago, they repaved the Dempster, the road in Skokie. So there are two kinds of people who help repave the road in Dempster, right? There's the large, oversized, hairy, sweaty guy in the truck who's actually smoothing out the road with a cup of Joe in his hand. Then there's a guy in the village office with a big piece of paper that's looking at the big map and trying to figure out, well, how does Dempster intersect with that crooked one, whatever that's called, Nile Center? And then, well, if we repave this over here, what's it going to do to the water main that's coming from Skokie Boulevard, etc.? Rashi, Lahavdil, is the large, oversized, sweaty, hairy guy in the truck. Lahavdil. Rashi's looking at the page and he's saying, I want to make sure you can work through this page of Talmud with no problems. Because remember, there are going to be pieces that are going to be out of place because it's going to be edited and it's going to be put together in a certain way that they'll continue the discussion. So Rashi's going to make sure that this is smooth. Comes Rabbeinu Tam and he says, that's all fine and good, very good. But wait a second, did we ever think to put this all out on the table? All, like, lay it all out. One huge canvas. And see how it all fits together. Wait a second, there's a passage over here in Masechet Shabbos that says this. But wait a minute, I know there's a Gemara in Moikatan that says that. So Rashi, to a large degree, is not going to deal with that because that's not his job. But Tosfos, the dialectic method that Rabbeinu Tam introduces is, wait a second, we're going to take these two and now have to resolve them. Well, that's going to be incredibly creative because now we're going to have to come up with a solution. So now all the rabbis in the Tosfos method are going to say, well, perhaps we can answer it by saying, there's a new situation here that we didn't take into consideration. Maybe this one is not the authoritative one. Maybe the girsa, the text is wrong. All these questions are now arising when you're going to study a page of Talmud. So let's go back to the page of Talmud.
Specifically looking at Rashi for his commentary, or were they independent of Rashi and actually just trying to think in a different way?
So the answer is, they were doing both. They refer to Rashi all the time. Rashi didn't write one long commentary. He wrote booklets called Kuntresim. So Tosfos will say, Pirish B'Kuntres. It says in the pamphlet. Who wrote the pamphlet? Rashi. So Rashi wrote pamphlets. Tosfos says, yeah, that's very fine and good to explain this. But Zeta, Grandpa, how do you explain the other Gemara? So he'll take Rashi, he'll throw him out the window and say, yeah, but really it must mean this. So if you look on the inside of every folio, some Gemaras don't have it. On the right side, you see Rashi. On the left side, you see Tosfos. This is pretty amazing stuff. So now, Rabbeinu Tam wrote almost nothing. He wrote almost nothing. He had an interesting life himself. He was born in Ramoreh. Ramoreh, you will see, is on the Google map.
With the A,
because I Google mapped it to find where is Ramoreh. It's a tiny hamlet. That's where Rabbeinu Tam was born, and he died in Tuan 1171. He was born in about 1100, let's say, I'll assume, and he died in Tuan in 1171. In 1146, he was in Ramoreh at the time on Shavuos, the second day of Shavuos. There was a group of anti-Jewish rioters who came in and ransacked the community. He was found, and he was beaten, nearly killed, until he told, the way he tells the story to his Talmidim, that there was some wealthy nobleman who was riding by on a horse who saw him lying in a field near his death, and he got somebody to help him out. And with that, he left Ramoreh and went back to live in Troyes. So, he died in 1171 after a massacre in Blois, which we can't talk about because we're already way over time. Here we are, Rabbeinu Tam, he's doing all this teaching, this incredible new creative method of how to resolve the tensions in the Talmud. The problem is, he's not writing anything down. Well, he has a nephew, his name is Rabbeinu Yitzchak. Rabbeinu Yitzchak ben Shmuel of Dampierre. He was born in Ramoreh in 1120, he dies in Dampierre in 1200. He becomes the key student of Rabbeinu Tam, who learns all these Torahs and all these techniques. But the Rebbe also doesn't write it down, he has an interesting method. He has pupils who he teaches it to, and they write it down, and then they review it with him. This is called the reportatio method, where the students learn it, and then they repeat it back to the teacher. And he had four primary pupils who came from these Germanic communities. One is Rav Shimshon of Sens. If you look on your map, where is Sens on here? Did I underline it? Shans. I didn't underline it. I don't know if I even put it on the map. Another one is Reb Elezer of Metz. Do we see Metz? If you go east. Northeast of Ramoreh, you'll see Metz.
North of Nancy.
Right, north of Nancy. There's Metz. Reb Elezer of Metz. He was one of the four chief pupils. He had a son, Reb Elchanan. He had a student, Reb Elezer of Metz. Reb Yehuda Sirleon. Sirleon, way to the bottom. There were other Tosas who lived in Orleans, Rabbi Chil of Paris, all these French Jewish communities, all had major rabbis. So he had four primary pupils who used to study the teachings, and then they would repeat it back to read. So now, who wrote the Tosas in our Gemara? Was it Rabbeinu Tam? No. Was it the Re? No! It was his students. So if you look at the end of the Tosas, you'll very often find two letters. It says Mem Reish. Mem Reish means Mipi Rabbeinu, from the mouth of our Rebbe. Who is that? It's one of the students of Rabbeinu Yitzchak of the Ri, saying, we heard this from the Ri. That's why, who are the most often quoted people in Tosfos? The Rabbeinu Tam, who is the source of all the knowledge, or most of the teaching, and the Ri, the person who was actually teaching it. Who authored most of the Tosfos in? The Reb Shimshon of Sens, the Rash Mishans. So now here you have this incredible dialectical movement that totally revolutionized the way the Torah study. So now, I will thank Rabbi Leonard Matenki for sharing this with me. This comes from an atlas called the Eitz Chaim Atlas, which I was never aware of until he showed it to me. It's a 15-volume atlas by somebody in Israel who's an incredible genius. Don't get overwhelmed. It's not so complicated. So now, you know, can I get two volunteers here, please? You want to come over here? Doctor, you ready? Okay. So now, I just want to make sure you're going to see exactly how the movement of the halacha is going to develop. The way that he does it here...
Okay.
So he's going to start at the bottom. This is early. This is, let's see, 960, right here. So this is the time of the four captives. This is Israel, Bavel, Tzfon Africa, Sfarad, Spain, and Sarfas, Ashkenaz. This is Provence. We'll get to that in a minute. So here we are down here. We have Rav Chushiel, Rabbeinu Hananel. See, it's not easy for you to see it. Yeah. But here's the Rif, and here is the Rambam. The Rambam is going to have several of his students who are going to influence, right? This is the development of Chachmei Sfarad that we spoke about. Then, parallel to that, here you have Rabbeinu Gershom, and the student of Rabbeinu Gershom, you're going to have Rashi. Now, Rashi is going to have his grandson, Rabbeinu Tam. You see how Rabbeinu Tam, these blue lines signify students. The red lines signify parent-father-son relationships. This Rabbeinu Tam, can I try you to raise it, please? There we go. Look at this, unbelievable. You see how many lines Rabbeinu Tam has? Because Rabbeinu Tam is influencing the entire community in Tzarfas. This is the entire development of the halacha. Now Rabbeinu Tam has his student, his nephew, the Ri HaZaken. So the Ri is teaching all these students, Rabbeinu Baruch Balatruma, and all these students. Now what's going to happen is, this is where it gets interesting, and I'm going to start with Mikatsa. I can't get to everything tonight. This is going to be impossible. Here is Nachmanides, Rabbeinu Moshe ben Nachman. He's living, he's born about 1200, he dies in 1270. He's living at the northern edge of Spain, in Girona. So he's living at the northern edge of Spain. Rabbeinu Tam, he's dying in 1171. So now you have a period of a couple of years where the Torah is starting to filter out from the Parisian Beit Medrash of the Chachmei Tzarfas. The Ramban had a Rebbe who was from Provence. Provence is the lower crust of France, just north of Spain, which we're going to skip over tonight because we're not going to have time to talk about that. His Rebbe in Provence was Rav Nosson ben Meir of Trinquetai. I've never been there. I don't know if it still exists. But Trinquetai is a tiny town. Rav Nosson ben Meir of Trinquetai, if you look very carefully on this piece, he was a cover of Rabbeinu Yonah. And if you look back, he, Rav Nosson ben Meir, who wrote a sefer called Shar HaTfisa that I never heard of, was a Talmud of the Ritzvah. The Ritzvah was a student of Rabbeinu Tam. We now have an incredible introduction of a totally new school of learning into the Spanish tradition. Because now, in addition to everything that the Spanish tradition had had before, in terms of the Rambam's rigorous analysis and categorization of the halachos, and the Rif's categorization of halachos, and their literal interpretation, now you're synthesizing all the Sephardic interpretations of the Gemara. Now the Ramban is bringing together all those traditions with the traditions of the Rabbeinu Tam's Tosafos method, and this is a revolution for Sephardic tradition, because now the Ramban, his students, Rav Shlomo ben Aderet from Barcelona, and his student, the Ritva, Rabbeinu Yitzchak al-Sevili from Seville, are now combining both of these methods, and all of a sudden there's a huge cross-pollination, because over the course of time, now the Tosafos method has moved, migrated south, and influenced in France, and at the same time, even though Rashi never saw the Rambam's teaching, but the Hagos Maimonides, who lived in the 13th century in Tzarfas, he starts to get a hold of the Rambam. So he's writing glosses on the Rambam. So the Rambam's position is going to start to be picked up and analyzed back here in Tzarfas. So there's this movement of the development of the halacha and the style, the halacha creativity, from one place to the other. Questions, comments, or observations?
How come Spartans have something different?
Oh, because at the end of the day, at the end of the day, what's happening in Sfarad? Yes, they're synthesizing what the Rabbeinu Tam has to say, but you know what they're going to say to Rabbeinu Tam? Sometimes they're going to say, ah, we have it better with the Rambam. Rabbeinu Hananel's pshat is better than your pshat. So they're going to be exposed to a different tradition, and their customs, and their style, and the influence of the Rambam is going to be huge here, but it's going to be much less over here. The influence of Rabbi Yutam is going to be massive here. So if you fast forward a few hundred years, which is going to be the topic of the next year, you fast forward to Shulchan Aruch, he's going to be picking up from Sfarad. Most of his influence is going to be coming from here, especially from the Rambam. The Rambam is going to follow the majority of the Rif, the Rambam, and the Rosh, Rabbi Noasher ben Yechiel, who migrates from here to here. That's a story we'll get to, we'll close with that. But the Ashkenazi tradition, Rav Moshe Isserles, he is going to be predicated on Rav Meir of Rothenburg and Rav Yisrael Isserlin, the Baal Truma Sadeshin. That's going to continue over here. So on the one hand, there's a deep-rooted tradition in these different communities. On the other hand, there is some intersection between the traditions from Tsarfas going over to France and then the Torah of the Rambam moving over this way. Any other? Thank you so much. This was fabulous.
This is like a silo. They're not getting influenced by anybody.
Yes.
And here you have a tremendous amount of cross-pollination.
So that's why in Eretz Israel and Italy, to a large degree, they're going to be isolated from a lot of these developments. Italy does not... They're going to have, over the course of time, Rav Nosson, Bala Oruch, but they're going to be largely to the periphery. That's why Minhagi Italia are so small. Minhagi Eretz Yisrael are so small. Where do you have? It's going to be Sfarad, because Sfarad is going to set the tone for Morocco, Egypt. The Rambam's influence is going to go all the way till Yemen. Because there was a lot, we don't think of it, but there was a lot of communication going on in those times by ship. So this is going to be all of North Africa, down to Saudi Arabia. Whereas this is going to be concentrated, it's going to start here in Tsarfas and Ashkenaz, but what's going to happen? At the end of the 13th century, all the Jews are getting kicked out of England, and then France, and then Germany. So this is all going to migrate. While this is still actually happening in Germany, this is going to migrate to
Russia.
Poland and Russia. Exactly. So that's going to be the development of all the halakhas from the Chachmei Ashkenaz.
The majority of the people are in dollars here.
Yeah, there's almost nobody left in Eretz Yisrael this time. So I want to close with one other piece, because we only got through half, but at least it was something. If you look back on your page, on your outline, we did at least a brief outline. We spoke about Sfarad 1 before the cross-pollination. We spoke about Ashkenaz and Sfarad 1 before the cross-pollination. We spoke about Ashkenaz number 2 and Sfarad number 2 with Rabbeinu Tam. And then we skipped Provence. We're not going to get to talk about Provence, which is the southern tip of France. And we spoke a little bit about Sfarad too, about this cross-pollination with the Ramban and his travels to Israel during the disputation. If you look back, it's interesting to think about, in terms of not just the numbers, in terms of the chronology, look at the influence of the rabbis. Go back to the page of the picture of Spain. Here's the Ramban, Nachmanides, living in the top right corner in Girona. That's heavily Christian Spain. But now, as the 13th century moves on, Christianity keeps moving south. And not only that, the influence of the Ramban and the Chachmei Ashkenaz that's coming with it, this synthesis is going south. Who is the student of the Ramban? The Rashba, Rabbeinu Shlomo ben Aderet of Barcelona. Look at Barcelona. That's just a drop farther south. His student was Rabbeinu Yom Tov Baal Sevili, from Seville all the way at the south edge. Where now, as the Christians keep pushing further south, almost concurrently, the traditions of these teachings are continuously being pushed south at the same time that there's being terrible persecution against the Jews. So while the golden age of Muslim Spain is waning, the Torah study continues until the Christians really shut it down. The end of the Tosfos movement, we saw on the page, we had the Rabbeinu Tam and the Ri. Then you have, we'll just close with the great sage, the Maharam of Rothenburg. Rav Meir of Rothenburg, he's born in 1215 in Worms. He dies in 1293. So he moves, he's living in Worms, which in that time is these Germanic little republics. He becomes one of the primary scholars of all of Ashkenazi Jewry. Much of what we Ashkenazi, and those of us who are in this room are Ashkenazi, what we have is due to the fact that it's Maharami Rutenberg. He was considered the great scholar of his generation. He had teachings from the students of the Baalei HaTosfos. So he's living at the end of the 13th century. But this is kind of like the foreshadowing for the migration, because in 1286, the local German noblemen were running out of cash. So they had a good idea, take all the money from the Jews. So they said, we're going to put a tax on all the Jews, you basically have to give us all your money. So the Jews said, that's bad. So we're going to leave. So then the government said, now Jews are not allowed to leave. So they were stuck between a rock and a hard place. Rami Rutenberg disguised himself and started to sneak out of Germany. He made it into France, but there's a little border town there where there was an apostate who saw him and turned him in. He was then imprisoned for 7 years in a prison in Inschersheim, I think that's how you pronounce it, back in Germany for 7 years, and he commanded the community. They were not allowed to ransom him, because he didn't want this to become a practice of hijacking rabbis, putting them in jail, and extorting the Jewish community. He spent 7 years in prison, and he died in prison in 1293. When he went to prison, he had many, many pupils. One of his star pupils was Rabbeinu Asher ben Yechiel de Rush. He left Germany, traveled through France, and settled in Spain. He was one of the first people who migrated actually to become a Sephardi Rav from being raised by the Maharami Rutenberg. The Maharami Rutenberg's bones stayed in the prison in Inschersheim for 14 years until the Jewish community ransomed him. One person just decided they couldn't have enough. But this is the kind of culture that's now developing in Western Europe, where there are, you know, you're talking Crusades, so you have 1096, and then you have more massacres in the 12th century, and then the 13th century. There was a play. There was a student of the Maharami Rutenberg who was called the Mordechai. If you look in the back of a Talmud volume, you will find the comments of the Mordechai. The Mordechai was killed in 1298 in the Rindfleisch massacres, also around the same time. So his students actually compiled his little notes, because he was massacred before he could even finish his work. So all of this is going to lead to the Jewish community, to a large degree, then the expulsion from France. They're going to leave and start migrating west. And that's where we're going to pick it up in Mirtz Hashem in 2 weeks. We're going to fast forward to the Shulchan Aruch and talk about the development of the Jewish community it's migrating east. Right, it's east. They're going to start migrating east to the Eastern European communities. I mean, there were Jews in Poland from the 1100s, but now you're talking about major Jewish communities. They also have their share of tsaros, but the bulk of the Jewish communities is going to move there, and essentially it's never going to return. The centers of Jewish learning are never going to return in a major way, the same to the degree that it is in Eastern Europe, in Western Europe, and there's going to be a major migration from the Sephardic lands. Why? Because of
Inquisition.
Bingo! The expulsion of the Inquisition. So then you're going to have a huge migration also to the east, but this time to Eretz Yisrael. So I hope that this helps shape some of the Jewish learning that we have, and I hope it wasn't too fast or too much. Mirtz Hashem, we look forward to continuing on July 10th at the home of Lenny and Jessica. Thank you to the Franks for hosting, and thank you everybody for coming.
Thank you.